This is Lecture 6 of The Foundations of Human Experience, formerly entitled Study of Man by Rudolf Steiner. This is the synopsis. An overview of the lecture cycle. Until now, consideration of the human being from the point of view of the soul and the body, and now from the point of view of the spirit. Levels of cognition, consciousness. Thinking, cognition, is fully conscious and awake. Feeling is half-conscious and dreaming. Willing is unconscious and sleeping. Working with dreamy and numb children. The completely wakeful life of the eye is possible only in pictures of the world, not in the real world. The life of the eye in activities of the soul, pictorial and awake in thinking cognition, dreaming, and unconsciously inspired in feeling, sleeping, and unconsciously intuitive in willing, nightmares. The rise of intuition, exemplified by Goethe's Creation of Faust, Part 2. The close connection of intuitive willing with pictorial cognition contrasted to inspired feeling. The existence of the head separate from sleeping willing. End of synopsis. Lecture 6, given in Stuttgart, August 27th, 1919. Until now, we have attempted to comprehend the human being from the perspective of the soul to the extent necessary for educating children. To have a complete picture, we will need to keep the spiritual, soul, and physical aspects separate and consider the human being from each of these points of view. We will first complete our consideration of the soul, since the soul lies closest to normal life. You will have noticed that we have already focused on the soul by using antipathy and sympathy as the main concepts for understanding the human being. It would not be appropriate to go directly from a consideration of the soul to a consideration of the physical body, since we know from spiritual scientific contemplation that we can understand the physical body only when it is approached as a revelation of the spirit and soul. Thus, to our general picture of the soul, we will now add a consideration of the human being from the perspective of the spirit. Only later will we discuss human nature in the way done by anthropology, namely how the human being appears in the physical world. Whenever you want to suitably consider the human being from any particular standpoint, you must always return to the three parts of the human soul, that is, to cognition that occurs in thinking, to feeling, and to willing. Until now, we have brought thinking or cognition, feeling and willing, into relationship with antipathy and sympathy. We now wish to consider willing, feeling, and cognition from the perspective of the spirit. From the spiritual point of view, you will also find a difference between willing, feeling, and thinking cognition. Consider the following. When you perceive cognitively, you must feel, parenthesis, I wish to express myself pictorially here, because a picture will help us understand, parenthesis, you must feel that, in a sense, you live in light. You recognize and experience that your I, capital I, is completely immersed in cognitive activity. In a sense, all the activity you call cognition is in everything your I, capital I, does. At the same time, when what your eye does is contained in cognitive activity. You are completely in the light and live in fully conscious activity. It would be horrible if you were not fully conscious in your cognition. Think about how it would be if you felt that when you are making a decision, something unconscious happens to your eye, and the result of this process is your decision. Suppose you would make a judgment, for example, quote, that person is a good person, unquote. You should be aware that what you need to be able to make this judgment, the subject person and the predicate is a good, is part of a process that for you is very present and is completely permeated by the light of consciousness. If you had to assume that while you were making the judgment, some demon or a natural cause tossed person together with being good, then you would not be completely conscious in this thought, and your judgments would always contain something unconscious. The important thing in thinking cognition is that you are completely conscious in the whole web of cognitive activity. This is not true with willing. You know quite well that when you develop the simplest form of willing, for instance walking, you live with full consciousness only in the idea of walking. You know nothing of what occurs with your muscles as you move one leg in front of the other, or of what occurs in the mechanism and organism of your body. Imagine all you would need to learn about the world if you wanted to go consciously through the process necessary in willing to walk. You would have to know exactly what nutrients your leg muscles and other parts of your body require when you walk. You have never calculated how much nutrition you need, but you know quite well that all this occurs very unconsciously in your body. When we will, we always mix something unconscious into our activity. However, the situation is not quite the same when we consider the nature of willing within our organism. Also, we do not completely comprehend, with the light of consciousness, what we do when we extend our willing to the external world. Suppose you have two vertical blocks and you decide to lay a third block across them. You need to differentiate precisely what lives in everything that you do in a fully conscious cognitive activity from what lives in your fully conscious cognitive activity when you make the judgment that someone is good, where your cognition is fully included. You need to differentiate what lives as cognitive activity from what you know nothing about, even though you do it with your full will. Why do the two columns support the beam lying upon them? Modern physics has only hypotheses about this. When people believe they know why the two columns support the beam, they are only fooling themselves. Everything people have created as concepts of cohesion, adhesion, the force of gravity, and so forth, are in principle only hypotheses for external knowledge. We count upon these hypotheses when we act. We count upon the fact that the two columns that are to carry the beam will not crumple if they have a certain thickness. Nevertheless, we can as little penetrate this entire event as we can penetrate the movement of our legs when we want to move forward. An element that does not reach our consciousness is mingled with our willing. In its broadest sense, willing has an element of unconsciousness in it. Feeling stands midway between willing and thinking. Feeling is permeated partially by consciousness and partially by unconsciousness. In this way, feeling partakes of the characteristics of cognitive thinking and of felt willing. What do we actually have before us from the spiritual point of view? You can come to grips with this from the perspective of the spirit only if you comprehend the facts I have just described in the following way. In normal life, we speak of a wakeful, conscious state. However, this state of consciousness exists only in the activity of cognitive thinking. If you wish to speak precisely about the extent to which people are awake, you must say that people are awake only when and if they perceive something through cognitive thinking. Now, how is it with willing? You all know the state of consciousness of sleep. You may also call it the state of unconsciousness. You know that we are not conscious of our experiences during sleep. It is the same with everything that enters our willing. As people, if we are willing beings, we sleep even when we are awake. We always have within us a sleeping person, namely the willing person, and accompany that person with the wakeful, the thinking, cognitive person. When we are willing beings, we also sleep from the moment of waking until going to sleep. There's always something sleeping in us, namely the inner essence of willing. We are no more conscious of this than of the processes that occur during sleep. We cannot completely comprehend the human being if we do not know that sleep plays into wakefulness when the human being is a being of will. Feeling exists in the middle, so we may now ask, how conscious is feeling? Feeling is midway between waking and sleeping. You experience feelings in your soul in the same way that you experience dreams, except that you remember dreams and you directly experience feelings. However, the inner mood of soul you have and know through your feelings is the same as the one you have through your dreams. When you are awake, you not only are awake when you are thinking, and asleep when you are willing, you also dream when you are feeling. There are, in fact, three states of consciousness during the time we are awake. That is, waking in cognitive thinking, dreaming in feeling, and sleeping in willing. Normal dreamless sleep is, from the perspective of the spirit, nothing other than the complete devotion of the human soul to what it is devoted to in daytime willing. Let me say that sentence again. Normal dreamless sleep is, from the perspective of the spirit, nothing other than the complete devotion of the human soul to what it is devoted to in daytime willing. The only difference is that in actual sleep, we sleep with our entire soul, and in waking, we sleep only with our willing. Concerning what we normally call dreaming, during sleep, we are devoted with our entire soul to what we call a dream. While awake, we are devoted to this dreamy state of soul only as feeling human beings. If you consider this pedagogically, the fact that children are different regarding the wakefulness of their consciousness will not surprise you. You will find that children who tend toward an excessive feeling life are dreamy children, so that children whose thinking is not yet fully awake become easily devoted to dreaming. You can be effective with such children through strong feelings. You can hope that these strong feelings will awaken the light of cognition in these children, since sleeping has a rhythm that tends to awaken after some time. If we approach a child who dreamily broods in his or her feeling with strong feelings, then the strong feelings we implant in that child will themselves awaken as thoughts after a time. Children who brood even more, who may even be numb to the life of feeling, have a tendency to be particularly strong-willed. If you consider this, you will see that you can unravel many puzzles in children's lives. You may have a child in class who appears to be completely stupid. You might judge that the child is mentally retarded or slow. You might examine him or her psychologically using memory tests and other such things done by educational psychologists. Then you might say that the child is retarded or slow and belongs in a school for mentally retarded children, or what is now popularly called a school for the developmentally disabled. Were you to make such a judgment, you would not come close to the nature of the child. Perhaps that child tends to be particularly strong in the will. Perhaps he or she is one of those children who later in life, out of choleric temperament, become especially active. But for now, the will is sleeping. If the thinking cognition of those children is destined to awaken only later, then the teacher must handle them in an appropriate manner, so that later in life they can be called to significant activity. At first, such children appear to be quite dumb, but may not be. You must have an eye for such children to awaken their will, i.e. That is, you must act upon their drowsiness, so that by and by, later in life, they can awaken their sleeping will, since all sleep has the tendency to awaken. Their will may be very strong, but now it only sleeps and is concealed by this sleeping. You must handle such children so that you count upon their capacity to understand and comprehend as little as possible. You must use things that, in a sense, hammer strongly upon the will of those children. For instance, when you are speaking, you also have them walk. When they are speaking, you also have them walk. Take such children, you will not have many of them, out of the class, and while they are speaking, have them walk. For other children, this would be exciting, but for those children, it is developmental. For instance, the step, man step, is step, good step. In this way, you connect the entire will with what is purely intellectual thinking, and slowly you will succeed in awakening the will to think in such children. Only the insight that in the waking human there are different states of consciousness, waking, dreaming, and sleeping, can bring us to a true understanding of our task regarding the developing human being. We can now ask something else. What is the relationship of the actual center of the human being, the capital I, to these different states. You will most easily comprehend this if you assume something that is undeniable, namely, that what we call the world or the cosmos consists of activities. For us as human beings, these activities are expressed in various ways throughout life. We know that forces are at work in life. For example, life energy is active all around us. Interwoven between the basic forces and life energy is everything that acts, for example, as heat and fire. Just think to what extent we exist in an environment where fire affects so much. In certain parts of the earth, for example, in southern Italy, you need only ignite a piece of paper, and at the same moment a great deal of smoke begins to come out of the ground. Why is this? This happens because when you ignite a piece of paper, the resulting heat thins the surrounding air, and the rising smoke draws up the forces that are otherwise under the earth's surface. By the time you drop burning paper onto the ground, you stand in a cloud of smoke. This is an experiment any tourist in Naples can conduct. I give this as an example of why, if we do not consider the world superficially, we must admit that we live in an environment everywhere permeated by forces. There are also forces higher than heat that exist in our surroundings. We are always moving through them as we go through the physical world. Although we are normally unaware of it, our physical body is so constituted that we can do this. In this way, we walk through the world with our physical body. We could not move through those forces with our eye, the most recent development in our evolution, if our eye needed to focus on them. The eye cannot concentrate on everything in its environment. The eye must still be protected from entering into all world forces. Some day it will develop sufficiently to be able to integrate into these world forces, but it cannot do so yet. Because the eye is completely awake, it is essential that we are not placed in the real world, that is, our surroundings, but only in a picture of the world. In our thinking cognition, we therefore have only the pictures of the world we already discussed from the perspective of the soul. Let us now consider this from the perspective of the spirit. In thinking cognition, we live in pictures. At the present stage of human development, between birth and death, we can live with our completely awake eye only in pictures of the cosmos, not yet in the real cosmos. Thus, when awake, our body must first present us the pictures of the cosmos, and then our eye lives in these pictures. Psychologists give considerable effort to determining the relationship between body and soul. They speak of an interaction between body and soul, of psychophysical parallelism and other such things. In principle, all these things are just childish concepts. The true process is that in the morning when the eye enters the waking state, it enters the body, not the physical processes of the body, but the world of pictures created at the innermost level of the body by external processes. In this manner, the eye is given thinking cognition. It is different with feeling. Here, the eye permeates the real physical body, not just pictures. If in this permeation, the eye were completely conscious, then it would, understand this from the point of view of the soul, literally burn up. If the same thing happened with feeling, that happens with thinking, when you permeate the pictures created by your body with your eye, then your soul would burn up. You could not bear it. You could only experience the permeation of feeling in a dreamy, reduced state of consciousness. Only in dreams can you endure what actually occurs in your body as feeling. You can endure what occurs as willing only when you sleep. If you had to experience everything that occurs when you will in normal life, your experience would be horrible. You would be gripped by terrible pain. If, for example, you really had to experience how the strength brought to your organism by food was used by your legs to walk. You are lucky you do not experience that, or rather, that you experience it only in sleep. To experience it wakefully would mean the worst pain thinkable, a terrible pain. We might even say that were we to become awake in willing, the pain that is otherwise latent and numbed by the sleepiness of the will would be conscious. Now you can understand my description of the life of the I during the time we normally call being awake, which includes fully awake, dreamily awake, and sleepily awake. That is, my description of what the I, as it lives in the body, in its normal state of wakefulness, actually experiences. The I lives in thinking cognition when it is awake in the body. There it is completely awake. However, it lives there only in pictures, so that human beings, if they do not do the exercises in my book How to Know Higher Worlds, live between birth and death only in pictures through their thinking cognition. Then the I enters partially awake into the processes that cause feeling. In feeling, we are not fully awake, only dreamily awake. How do we experience what we go through in feeling in this dreamy state of wakefulness? We experience it in what has always been called inspiration, inspired imagination, unconscious inspired imagination. It is the source of everything that rises to wakeful consciousness from the artist's feelings. Only there is it experienced. There, everything that often rises as a sudden inspiration into wakeful human consciousness and then becomes pictures is experienced. In my book, How to Know Higher Worlds, what I call inspiration is only the unconscious inspiration of feeling that everyone has raised to the light of fully conscious experience. When people with particular abilities speak of their inspirations, what they actually speak of is what the world lays into their feeling and what, due to their personal capacities, they allow to rise into their fully awake consciousness. It is just as much a part of reality as the content of thoughts. However, between birth and death, these unconscious inspirations reflect those cosmic processes that we can only experience dreamily, lest our I burn up or suffocate in them. Such suffocation often begins with people in abnormal states. Remember what happens when you have a nightmare. Then there is an attempt to change the relationship between you and the air into an abnormal one, similar to what exists when this relationship is not healthy. Since this change wants to enter into your I consciousness, you will not be conscious of it as something normal, but rather as something tormenting you, namely as a nightmare. All breathing, every breath, would be just as tormenting as the abnormal breathing of a nightmare if you had to experience it with full consciousness. You would experience it in your feeling, but it would be very painful for you. For this reason, it is numbed, and thus you do not experience it as a physical process, but only as a dreamlike feeling. The processes that play out in willing would be terribly painful. Therefore, we may say, as a third thing, that the I sleeps in willed activity. What we experience only in sharply reduced consciousness, in sleeping consciousness, in unconscious intuition. People continually have unconscious intuitions, but these live in willing. People sleep in their willing and are therefore unable to bring it up into normal life. Unconscious intuitions come into life only under the most favorable circumstances, and then people dully experience the spiritual world. There is something peculiar in normal human life. We all know the complete consciousness in the wakefulness of thinking cognition. There we are, so to speak, in the light of consciousness. We all experience it. Often, when people begin to think about the world, they say that they have intuitions. Undefinable feelings come from these intuitions. What people say can often be very confusing, or it can be ordered unconsciously. When a poet speaks of intuitions, it is quite proper that they are not derived from the source lying closest at hand, namely from the inspiration of the feeling life, but rather that they are brought from the unconscious intuitions arising in the region of the sleeping will. Those who have insight into these things can see the underlying principles in even the most superficial coincidences in life. You may, for example, read the second part of Goethe's Faust and want to thoroughly understand how the unusual construction of these verses came about. Goethe was quite old at the time when he wrote the second part of Faust, at least most of it. He wrote it by dictating to his secretary, John. Had Goethe actually written, he would probably not have created such curiously devised verses. While he dictated, Goethe continuously paced up and down in his small study in Weimar, and this pacing back and forth is part of the conception of the second part of Faust. In that Goethe developed an unconscious willing deed in his pacing, something arose out of his intuition, and what he had someone else write down on paper was visible in his external activity. Say that you wanted to make a table of the life of the capital I in the body, and you made it in the following manner. 1. Waking-pictorial cognition. 2. Dreaming-inspired feeling. 3. Sleeping-intuitive willing. Then you would not be able to understand why the intuition people instinctively speak of arises more easily in the pictorial recognition of everyday life than in inspired feeling, which is closer. However, if you correctly draw this, the table above is incorrect. If you draw it in the following way, then you will more easily understand these things. He has a wheel, or literally a circle divided into three equal parts, like a pie. And in one he has waking, imaginative cognition. In number two he has, that's at the top, and then to the right he has 2, dreaming, inspired feeling. And to the lower left he has 3, sleeping, intuitive willing. And he has arrows pointing, showing that the entire circle is rotating clockwise. Reading Steiner again. You would then realize that pictorial cognition enters inspirations in the direction of arrow 1, and that's arrow 1's going from 1 into 2. However, the cognition indicated by arrow 1 is the entering into the body. Let me read that again. However, the cognition indicated by arrow 1, going from waking in imaginative cognition into dreaming inspired feeling, the cognition indicated by arrow 1 is the entering into the body. Now observe yourselves. Right now you are sitting or standing quietly and are involved in thoughtful cognition and observation of the outer world. You are living in pictures. What the capital I otherwise experiences in world processes enters the body first through feeling, then through willing. You pay no attention to what is in feeling, nor at first to what is in willing. Only when you begin to walk, when you begin to act, do you first become aware of willing, not feeling. In the process of entering into the body, and then again of rising in the direction indicated by arrow 2, arrow 2 goes from 3 to 1, sleeping intuitive willing, and to waking imaginative cognition. Read that again. In the process of entering into the body, and then again of rising in the direction indicated by arrow 2, intuitive willing comes closer to pictorial consciousness than does dreamy, inspired feeling. Thus you will find that people often say that they have a vague feeling. What I have described in my book How to Know Higher Worlds as intuition is then confused with the superficial intuition of normal consciousness. Now you can understand the form of the human body. For a moment, think of yourself walking and observing the world. Imagine that it is not your lower body that walks, but that your head has legs and could walk. Then your observation of the world and your will would be completely intertwined, resulting in your being able to walk only when asleep. However, because your head sits upon your shoulders and upon the remainder of your body, it rests upon the body. It rests, and you carry your head because you move only the remainder of your body. However, the head must be able to rest upon the body, otherwise it could not be the organ of thinking cognition. The sleeping will must be removed from it, because if you could set it into motion, removing it from its relatively motionless state and giving it its own movement, then the head would sleep. The head allows the body to accomplish actual willing and lives in this body as in a carriage, allowing itself to be moved about in this manner. It is possible for human beings to be wakefully active only because the head allows itself to be moved about by the body as if in a carriage, and during this movement, the resting head is at the same time active. You can truly grasp the form of the human body only if you comprehend things this way. That's the end of Lecture 6.